This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 5th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 455. On this edition, the FIFA World Cup continues and the MMA panel returns for the 2026 halftime edition. 6 months gone, 6 months to go. Mario Canseco, president of Research Co. and the Duke of Data, Andy Yan, director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University, joined me on a rainy day at Lonsdale Quay to talk a lot about politics and economics, and next door at the Uber Eats Canada Soccer House at the Shipyards to watch some soccer. This is the Breaker.News podcast. This is the MMA panel. I'm Mackin, and that's the other M, Mario Canseco, president of Research Co., and that's the A, Andy Yan, the director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University, the Duke of Data. And here we are for the MMA panel after the second quarter of 2026. It's halftime, basically. We're taking a World Cup theme. It's halftime of 2026. And we've already had one hydration break so far. You know, we've had two quarters, but we really just have one hydration break. So that's where we are right now. We're at halftime of the year, and we're going to rate and debate what has happened this year here in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We're at Lonsdale Quay. We're underneath a roof right now. We're near the Shipyards, which is one of the watch party locations. It's the Canada Soccer House. Sponsored by Uber and the City of North Vancouver, but it's raining out, so we thought we'd do the podcast underneath the roof here at Lonsdale Quay. And want to get to city issues first. We're across Burrard Inlet from City of Vancouver, and City of Vancouver has been an interesting place for the second quarter of the year. We had ABC, Ken Sim and his party, go into campaign mode. They promised more income tax, more property tax freezes. Of course, they'd love to freeze income tax, but that's not their jurisdiction. They're promising about $400 million in rec center upgrades if they get reelected in the fall election, October 17th. Ken Sim also made a trial balloon to try to start a campaign to get Vancouver into Major League Baseball, bring an expansion franchise to Vancouver. He did that, oddly, as the lead-up accelerated to the FIFA World Cup, which we're in right now. If an election were held today, who would win the mayoralty? If an election were held today, who would win majority on City Council, which is currently held by Ken Sim and ABC? First to Mario Canseco of Research Co.
I think it would be a re-election of Ken Sim if the election were held today. We don't see a lot of people paying attention to municipal politics yet. There's a complexity in the way in which the anti-Ken Sim vote has been spread out, part to Karim Alam, part to Pete Fry, part to also One City and Cope. It's a very nascent campaign. Stephanie Allen has been campaigning for Cope just for about a month. So it's early, but there's also no indication that the level of dismay about the way things are going has been enough to galvanize over one candidate particularly. So it could be a situation where Ken Sim can win the election with 35, 37, 38% of the vote. It's a drop from the 51% that he got the last time. But it's still winnable because of the way in which the opposition votes are spread out.
I'd actually have to agree with Mario that I think that there is, I think, a fragmentation within the opposition to Ken Sim. I think that Ken Sim probably has a really good chance of certainly winning the mayoralty council. I think that, that there's always this idea that people will have this incredibly insightful liberal idea of just picking the candidates they want. Typically, no, they don't. They vote on slates. And I think as such, I think that it could very much be at this point, mind you, there's still 3 more months in terms of campaigning, that it could be a Ken Sim majority to kind of come back to council. But I think that it's also, I think, one through which 3 months, anything can happen in 3 months. And I think that we'll see. But I think part of this is also perhaps riding on the FIFA vibes and really what will happen. I think there's still a little bit left in terms of FIFA. But then also when the bills start coming in, and then what the responses are going to be.
Yeah, the big question is when the bills start coming in, because this is a project which has ballooned in cost. Yeah. estimated to be as much as $729 million by the provincial government. That includes federal and provincial expenditures. The big line item is security, $242 million. We're seeing that throughout Vancouver and surrounding communities with the amount of RCMP officers, police from Calgary and Edmonton. We're seeing it in the sky. There's been Canadian Forces refueling jet in the sky. There's the RCMP Black Hawk helicopter doing rounds of the city. Of course, Ken Sim would point to the big crowds on Granville Street, and the big crowds that have gone to matches at BC Place and the marches to the match on the last mile. But in an event like this, there's always the question of whether every community in the city actually shares in this. And there's a lot of questions about that, and many are saying that they're not, because as economists established, that this isn't a normal event, and it changes the economy.
Right. And a lot of this is really coming into another economic concept called the substitution effect. This does tend to be a fairly busy time of year anyways in Vancouver, whether it's coming from the cruise or the convention season, that this is really a busy time. And yet, at the same time, the kind of folks who aren't coming into Vancouver have perhaps been substituted by those who are coming in for the World Cup. But yet, I think the mixed data that's coming in towards occupancy, towards really how hotels aren't necessarily seeing the kind of windfall they were expecting, I think really has put forward towards it's certainly, I think, and we see the streets activated during game days, that certain kind of brought a certain buzz to the city. But yet it's also, I think, brought into, and I think a really interesting example is going to Italian Day on the drive a few weeks ago, that on that game day, talking to some of the folks on the drive, you actually had last year, they had almost 500,000 participants, but yet this year they had 300,000. So it's certainly like where those folks perhaps went to was not to Italian Day, but maybe to Granville. But yet I think kind of shows you how the economic activity was spread, but didn't necessarily grow.
Now you've experienced the World Cup in Mexico City. How does it compare to what you've seen in Vancouver? And are these rosy projections of economic largesse, economic greatness, any chance of them coming true? Or is this really just the feel-good factor?
I think for the most part, it's the feel-good factor. It takes a while to actually figure out whether the math made sense, whether you made money out of this. There's talk about a 2038 bid because North America would have to host the World Cup again. And, you know, there's a level of excitement that comes with the team doing well, which is similar to what we experienced in 2010. You know, people were really scared about what was going to happen with the Olympics and how it was going to make their lives more difficult and their commute longer. And, you know, once the medals started falling, people sort of forgot about that. But this is different, particularly because of what it means for politicians. You think about 2010, Gordon Campbell wasn't doing great. We had the discussions about the HST, and there he was waving the flag at every event he could. It didn't pan out great for him because he wasn't premier at the end of 2010. And I think there's an opportunity for Ken Sim, for David Eby, for Mark Carney even, to say, you know, we did something great, nothing weird happened, everything fell the way we expected it to, there were no major security challenges, and this is an example of what can happen. Now, we're still in the middle of it, so it's tough to tell what is going to happen at the end. But if you're asking me to compare 86 in Mexico with what we're seeing here, the biggest change has been the complexities in getting to the places. The fact that FIFA has grown so much. In Mexico City, you could get to the stadium in your own vehicle. You can't do that in any of the venues that are being used for FIFA this year. So part of it is also the fact that in 1986, FIFA placed conditions on a government, whether it was the city or the national government, which was the same back then, because essentially the mayor of Mexico City was appointed by the president. Here it's a different situation where FIFA is the one calling the shots, and it has been happening for months.
Well, there are ways and means, if you pay the price, that you can drive to the stadium, but you're paying the price to FIFA, and FIFA has its price. And again, the price of this event will be debated for many months and years to come, just like the price of the Vancouver 2010 Olympics. And we're recording this on July 2nd, so we're past the halfway point. We're almost finished the schedule of matches at BC Place. there are still are more matches to be seen, more events to happen, especially at the Fan Festival, the PNE, where there have been questions about some match days being very well attended, but many match days not so much, especially in the amphitheater, which is the new venue, $183 million new amphitheater. Now, speaking of big costs, and we're here on the North Shore, we're in North Vancouver, not too far away from the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant, and that was one of the news items that did happen in the second quarter of 2026, was that Metro Vancouver came to an out-of-court settlement with Acciona, the Spanish company that was hired to build the project, that was fired from the project. This is a project that has gone $3 billion over, and the big question is, will we ever find out who is to blame and for what reason in this project?
No. What I'm hopeful about something, though, and it's whether this is going to lead to a larger discussion about Metro Vancouver governance. Many Metro Vancouverites do not understand how this is happening. You have councillors from small places or mayors from small places making decisions and voting on things like this. I think it's going to be one of the elements that is going to make the municipal race compelling. You have candidates who are running who have said, we don't want to take money from Metro, we shouldn't be paid for our time when we go to these meetings. It's part of our duty as elected representatives for our municipalities. And whoever wants to defend the status quo is going to be in a lot of trouble in debates, because people are very upset with the fact that this keeps ballooning. It's exceedingly more expensive than when it was first put forth. And now we have a scenario where you have people who are going to say, it's okay, Metro Vancouver works perfectly and we shouldn't be concerned about this. I think this is going to lead to a significantly larger discussion about whether we should have these people elected directly, which is what happens in other major metro areas.
I think it's going to bring in some, I think, pretty important conversations around regional governance, what that regional governance and the kind of service provisions that ought to occur and how do we pay for it, because it's critical. I mean, in one way, a part of regional governance in Metro Vancouver, when it comes to services, is the fact that it kind of has worked. Like, when was the last time you thought about cholera in your drinking water? That, I mean, there's an element for which the system did work, and yet, but then with how things are changing in the region, how populations are redistributing throughout the region, comes into a question of accountability and leadership. I think that it's interesting to kind of see where the two biggest municipalities, Vancouver or Surrey, kind of go into this kind of regional leadership that I think is part of the importance of a city, that it's not only the individual cities, but how do they work together on these issues that are of mutual interest and of mutual concern that can only be solved collectively. So I think that this is really an opportunity to kind of review really how we do regional governance and the kind of services that it can provide, because of the fact that we are very much stronger together than we are apart, but yet what that looks like, I think, is a key question.
And speaking of Surrey, that's another big issue there, the cop swap that won't stop. Now, the Surrey Police Service is, of course, the police of jurisdiction, took over from the RCMP. Elements of the RCMP still assist in policing of parts of Surrey. It is not yet complete. They still have to hire more officers in Surrey, and one officer that's no longer with them is the chief officer. Chief Norm Lipinski was fired by the Surrey Police Board, and we're still trying to find out why and how much it's going to cost taxpayers in Surrey. This is a story that just won't end.
I think it very much kind of goes in and to the municipality's role and their relationships also to the province. That I think this is also one through which is a kind of comedy, through which has multiple players, through which I think they themselves are trying to figure out exactly what their roles are and really what does it mean for the city of Surrey as it kind of grows into quite possibly being the largest city in British Columbia, probably within the next 3 or 4 years. And I think that this is part of the kind of growing pains, and yet it's kind of ability or inability to kind of look at governance. And I think that this is a really big challenge, as you got, particularly when it comes to police services, in terms of how are they provided, what are the metrics towards successful services. I think the kind of profound ongoing issues in terms of public safety and really how they are going to come and work together within the city, but then also I think between the with with elements like the RCMP and I think other parts of the region. And I think this also goes into that, again, what we had previously talked about in terms of regional governance, through which I think policing is, of course, a growing issue and what that might look like. So I think that at the end of the day, will we find out? Probably not. But then at the same time, I think that it's really going into what does policing in what will likely be, what will be the largest municipality in British Columbia look like, I think is the critical question here.
It's a question as well, at this early stage of the municipal race, of municipal pride. Surrey was a city where 25 years ago everybody made jokes about. It's a different mentality. I think there's a tendency for the candidates running to try to have something that they can hold on to. Linda Hebner wanted a Ferris wheel. Doug McCallum wanted a canal. No. Then Doug McCallum wanted to build a Panda Dome. I think this is a similar scenario. We have the Vancouver Giants moving here if we do this. You know, we can finally be part of where we see ourselves, which is a significant component of Metro Vancouver.
The Brand Arena.
Yeah, that's a good way of calling it. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that can get voters out there, because Surrey didn't have a particularly high voter turnout the last time, and it, even for the municipal numbers that we usually have across Metro. So this is a way to get young people interested in politics. It might work. It certainly didn't in some of the other projects that we've seen. But it's going to be significantly easier for Brenda Locke to look as a competent manager when your main opponent is going to be somebody who used to be mayor and is sending 17-page press releases every time something goes wrong.
And on the provincial scene, in the second quarter of 2026, that's when most of the business at the legislature was done in Victoria, you had David Eby putting his government on line, basically, with DRIPA, the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. He promised to amend it, and he was going to put it to a confidence vote in the legislature, which meant the government could have fallen on that issue and triggering a snap election. He backed away from that due to pressure from the various Indigenous lobby groups, especially Union of BC Indian Chiefs. Stuart Phillip, the Grand Chief, is the head of that, and his wife, Joan Phillip, is an MLA in David Eby's caucus, and she's had some health problems, but she was quite blunt in her opposition. And the continuing uncertainty over whether private land is covered under land claims. The Couch and Tribes decision is slowly making its way to the BC Court of Appeal. That's probably going to take a few more years because it'll end up in the Supreme Court of Canada. So you had that happening. You had further budget problems. The NDP actually canceled the next phase of the Burnaby Hospital expansion. And seniors housing projects, they canceled the contracts, even though the NDP calls it repacing. That's their grand new euphemism that they spent probably hours trying and days coming up with. They fought tooth and nail in the legislature session to what they say is improve the freedom of information law, but the Conservatives said no, it actually weakens it. And people on my side of the fence as well say, yeah, it was weakened. You know, more power taken away from the public to find out how their government works and how their taxpayers' money is being spent. Opinion polls such as yours that are raising questions about the future of David Eby as premier of the province, as leader of the NDP. He won the last election just barely. Questions whether he could carry this party into the next election and come out the other side a winner. What do you think of David Eby's future as leader of the NDP and premier of the province?
I think it depends on the way they can frame the question about Kerry Lynn Findlay. I think this is the best outcome for them as far as who the leader of the party called the BC Conservatives would have been. Caroline Elliott would have been a much more complicated opponent, better spoken, younger, somebody with experience like Ian Black or Peter Milovar. They could have been formidable foes against David Eby. And I think they look at Kerry Lynn Findlay and say, we have this blank canvas that we can define. So many things that have happened in the past, so many discussions, so many instances in which, you know, she used to be for LGBTQ rights and now she's saying that she maybe isn't. And also the vast array of social media morsels that have been left behind by Bruce Chapman. So it's an opportunity. There's an opportunity for the NDP to try to define this as a way of saying, yeah, maybe things aren't that great now, but do you really want these people to be in charge of things? And I think that's one of the reasons why they really try to hammer hard on the idea of if the government falls, this is what you're getting, yeah, even though it was before Caroline Findlay. So it's not a great situation to be in. I mean, usually what you want is to for the voter to see you as somebody who's competent and who can, you know, steer the ship through and who can withstand the challenge of an opposition. But this is in essence a repeat of the 2024 election. Here's John Rostad. I don't trust him. I don't know who he is. And I don't think this is the right course of action, even though I'm really disappointed with what the NDP has become after John Horgan left office. So they're hoping for something similar.
Andy, do you think that the NDP could go into the next election with David Eby as leader and come out the other side with another slim majority or maybe minority? Or do you think that they want to look at changing gears themselves, bringing the party closer to the center, looking at its labor base, bring in someone like Brad West to try to rescue their fortunes and regain a sizable majority so there's no uncertainty for the future? Someone who could actually bring people back to the party who may have strayed over to the conservative side of things.
Well, that's a really interesting question in terms of where that base is for the NDP at this moment. I think that a lot of this is, I mean, it's interesting to kind of see how politics these days is kind of defined on who the opposition is for those in government and really how you can define the pace of the game. And I think that this is really, I think, going into one for which having Findlay as the conservative leader is actually a gift, very much a gift to David Eby. And I think that one might think, but he's also, I think, in one way, kind of challenged his own supporters. I think that mixed into this list, I think you have to also bring in the postponement of the community housing fund, and that really, I think, disappointed a lot of base supporters for Eby. And whether he'll bring back some elements in terms of spending, in terms of non-market housing, is also going to be kind of this rapprochement. And I think that that's really an interesting question to kind of bring back the kind of supporters. But I think at this point, I think that this moment in terms of watching the death watch for David Eby's leadership, I think it's been deferred. I think that there is, I think, this moment for which I think we'll see how the kind of responses he will do to I think various other issues, particularly around the economy. I think his biggest challenge is around the economy now in terms of economic development, as well as what's going on in the housing realm, as it seems to be a very dynamic and speaking of an ill-defined area, really the kind of challenges in terms of what kind of policies they're going to do and what kind of deals they make with the feds.
If I could take us back to the year 2008, when the NDP was ahead of the BC Liberals, but when we asked people about Carol James, 30%, 35% said, I don't know who she is. So you could be upset at the government that's in place. And then once you get a sense of who is going to be out there running the show, if you vote for the opposition, then things change. The BC Liberals got a majority again in 2009, but a year earlier, people were thinking, this is the worst Gordon Campbell is going to be. It wasn't. It was after the HST discussions back in 2010. But you know, things can change very drastically and very rapidly once you figure out that you're actually electing a government and not just voicing your displeasure about the status quo.
And one key element is Caroline Findlay actually getting into the legislature when there can be a by-election and a safe seat, so she can take a seat in the legislature and then lead the opposition in the question period and hammer away at the NDP. We may be months away from seeing that. We don't know if there's going to necessarily be a fall session of the legislature. There is one on the schedule, theoretically, but it's up to the party in power, as we've seen before with the BC Liberals deciding not to go back into the legislature for a fall session, put their energy into regrouping, fundraising, and then getting ready for the next year's budget. Flipping over to federal issues, federally, you've had Mark Carney and his elbows up revolution continue. A couple of big decisions here that involve the real estate industry. The artificial intelligence data centers announcement with TELUS. Ian Gillespie of West Bank, who has gone through a lot of troubles with his company in recent years because of real estate deals, because of the economic impacts, because of less foreign money flowing into British Columbia, has jumped on the AI bandwagon, and his central heat distribution facility near BC Place is going to become a downtown AI data center, despite protests that are starting to mount by people who are against taxpayers' money going into AI and the potential economic harm, environmental harms they could place. So you had that situation, and then you had the condo bailout. You know, Ian Gillespie was one of those titans of real estate locally who went to that Mark Carney fundraiser at Bob Rennie's back in February. This has become a bit of a political hot potato for both of these leaders.
Well, there's a policy that is particularly popular every time I ask, and it's the foreign buyers ban. That's not going to change. I think they were hoping for some sort of modification to that. It's a popular idea because people are worried about housing, particularly those aged 18 to 34. This announcement was rushed. The policy wasn't properly explained. And when you need to explain the policy 3 days later, 5 days later, a week later, the opposition has already defined it for you. And I think that is part of the problem that we're having. It allowed Linda Hebner as the critic for housing for the BC Conservatives and Pierre Poilievre himself as the leader of the official opposition to come out and say this is a problem and we don't like it. Now, is that going to change the fortunes of the parties? It's too early to tell. But it's very complicated to appeal to a group of voters that is concerned about housing and say that this is going to benefit you. You know, you need to see the number of units, you need to have some sort of emotional connection to the issue. And I think that is what makes this such a complicated argument. You know, you have the emotional connection on transit when you caught a ribbon in a new SkyTrain station. But this is going to affect a small number of people. And it's not going to be easy for the government to say, we managed to do something like this. It also brings back the major discussions about Gregor Robertson's role as mayor of Vancouver. And it's led to a scenario that is not great for developers, which is the notion that they get a pass on many of the mistakes that they make in their businesses, whereas the rest of the public doesn't have that relationship and doesn't have the prime minister of the country coming to your house for a fundraiser.
I'm still trying to figure this one out. That a lot of this actually started off with, I think, you know, it's the eve of the Qatar Canada World Cup game, and I think perhaps the thought was we'll make this big announcement around housing, which is one of the issues that is currently defining both the federal and provincial, I think, field. And I think that it's really, I think, one for which I think there were thoughts that this would be a big win, that certainly, I think, for certainly part of the development sector, the changes in terms of how development cost charges or infrastructure is going to be paid for was seen as a big win, was actually something that they had directly asked for. And yet the kind of four-year kind of federal, provincial kind of payment into that system, I think, was seen as a big win for development in metropolitan and in British Columbia. But yet, I think what happened was, I don't think they really consulted the municipalities. They didn't consult with the regional board, that they are actually the ones who are actually do the work in terms of the provision of infrastructure. And I think that this is really, I think, something that I think is one trying to figure out exactly what they were trying to do. That you have to remember that $3.2 billion that was announced as part of that project was actually just for the infrastructure, for the development cost charges. There was no price tag for the 2,200 condominiums, and at that point it was spoken of as a condo conversion program, and then by focusing on these units as a kind of condo conversion, it then later on got shifted to a rent-to-own scheme. It's like, what is this? And I think that it kind of goes into perhaps what was probably almost its fatal first step in its design. It didn't focus on the people they're trying to house. That instead of looking at 2,200 condo units, perhaps they could have talked about the 2,200 or perhaps 2,400 households that they could have housed. That what are these households they are trying to house? Because the interface between those that are going to house and the gap between those that they're trying to house with the current housing market, I think, is perhaps one through which the public has a particular ear to for. But then structurally, there's also now a bigger challenge, because when we talk about newly built unsold condominiums in metropolitan Vancouver, we're actually at 36-year highs. And at 4,400 units, we don't know necessarily the physical sizing and the locations of these units, although the majority of them are located in Richmond's Burnaby and Coquitlam, that there is actually a growing challenge in terms of unabsorbed housing in the city that is built but yet unsold housing in the region through which, and the province through which, I think is probably going to be a growing issue in the coming months.
Okay, and finally, the tough question, toughest question of all, who will win the World Cup on July 19th? Who will be on the stage in New Jersey with Donald Trump and with Gianni Infantino accepting the trophy and lifting it high while the world watches?
Spain.
All my guys are out, so I'm just gonna join whatever bandwagon that that is an underdog.
Well, I'm thinking that this possibly could be England's year.
Oh, wow.
They could have done it in 1986, except for the hand of God in Mexico City. You know, they have to get over a big hurdle in Mexico City against Mexico, but maybe Harry Kane can lead England to glory and. Put to bed all those doubters for so many years. So I'm thinking maybe it's England's year.
Well, cool. They go back to the same stadium where the hand of God happened 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But now they have VAR, so it's good.
Well, VAR, of course, VAR could have been useful in 1966, according to the Germans.
English fans don't want to go back that far.
No. So that's it for the MMA panel on the Breaker.News podcast. Thanks again to Mario Canseco, president of Research Co., and to Andy Yan, the director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University, the M, and the A, for halftime of 2026. Thanks for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 28th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Bookmark the Breaker.News and the Breaker.ca. Follow on social media. We're on X, Threads, and Blue Sky. Follow the YouTube channel for The Breaker videos and sign up for the free email newsletter, bobmackin.substack.com. Become a paid subscriber, get early access to podcasts. Thanks again, and until next week.